G'day, I'm Rowan Mackie, and I'm joined by my dad, clinical psychologist Chris Mackie, and this is Psych Spiels and Silver Linings. G'day, Dad. How are you going today?
Good, thanks, Rowan. Good to be with you again.
Good to be with you as always, and good to be with you on what is a fascinating topic that we've got again today. We're continuing our little exploration on meaning. We've called today's episode Logotherapy and the Search for Meaning. So I'm very much looking forward to today's episode, Dad. We'll be talking about, or who I think anyway, is really one of the most inspiring characters in just about all of history and certainly in modern history. So what are we going to be talking about today?
Yes, it's the contribution of Viktor Frankl, a person who wrote the book Man's Search for Meaning that I think many people might have read but certainly heard of, people listening to the podcast. And he was a very inspiring character, Viktor Frankl, because he thought that having a sense of personal meaning was very important in life, very important for well-being, very important to deal with challenges in life. And he developed his ideas and understanding further through having experienced concentration camps in the Holocaust. And he was imprisoned for several years. Many people died through that time in the camps where he was. Sadly, he lost his pregnant wife. His parents were killed as well. He had all sorts of, well, you can imagine the worst hardship we can probably imagine is being in a concentration camp where you can't even count on living for any length of time. And yet it was in that particular context that he further refined and developed his beliefs on the importance of meaning in everyday life. And he subsequently wove that into a psychotherapy, an approach called logotherapy about meaning. And so we're going to be talking about some of the principles today that came up in logotherapy and some of the context of how Viktor Frankl came to see things in that way, the importance of meaning. So we're updating what we talked about from the Stoic philosophers and the ancient Greek philosophers. A lot of their philosophy gravitated towards the importance of meaning. Well, Viktor Frankl modernized those terms and introduced it into therapy in the mid-20th century.
Well, I think that's absolutely right in terms of his contribution, which we'll explore a little bit more. But one of the things that I find fascinating, in some ways continuing on from last week, like I found a little bit of a quote from Frankl where he said, "Our perspective on life's events, what we make of them, matters as much or more than what actually befalls us. Fate is what happens to us beyond our control, but we each are responsible for how we relate to those events." So, like, that reminds me in so many ways of that quote from Epictetus about we are not disturbed by things, but by our view of them. And I suppose, you know, not to kind of trivialize it with colloquial language, because I think, it was obviously some of the worst hardship anyone's ever gone through to go through the concentration camp system. But I almost look at Viktor Frankl as someone who, in many ways, took these ideas to the big leagues. It's one thing to have these ideas and in many ways play around with them in a philosophical sense, but he really backed it up in terms of the experiences that he had and how he was able to get through those. He drew upon much of this philosophy and I think added to it and developed it even after the war and after this experience of being in concentration camps, including Auschwitz, which is the most famous one.
Yes, and interestingly, he's been one of the most influential people in shaping positive psychology, where in positive psychology it highlights the importance of going beyond a pleasurable life, because pleasure will only last so long, even in engaged life, where you're doing things that might be absorbing or interest you to a degree, but by the same token it might not have certain levels of meaning, onto a meaningful life, which Martin Seligman defined in positive psychology as largely using your unique attributes and your greatest character strengths in the service of other people. And we'll see that Viktor Frankl had this real emphasis on doing things for the benefit of others, looking beyond yourself to find satisfaction in life, to really be fulfilled. We need to get beyond ourselves, so to speak, and serve others or something larger than ourselves. And that came up as one of the strong themes in logotherapy, now comes through in positive psychology.
Well, he seems to be someone who, in many ways, really put, I suppose, a bit of a structure around the ideas of meaning and the search for meaning. And that is something that has, as you say, been taken up by positive psychology. And we will talk a little bit more maybe at the end of today's podcast in terms of some of the more modern relevance to Viktor Frankl's work. But one of the things that I just find so interesting is how much meaning and purpose is a theme that many people think about and have questions about and focus on these days. And it seems that Viktor Frankl was just a huge contributor to meaning being seen as such an important thing.
Yes, and perhaps another contribution of Viktor Frankl in looking at meaning and the way he highlighted it as looking at something more transcendent, looking outside ourselves. He was a man of religious faith, but he emphasized the notion of serving something larger. It could also be a cause, serving a cause for other people. So there was a spiritual element to this. And some people would have described Frankl as being someone who brought more soul into psychotherapy. And that's something we've talked in the past also in terms of synchronicity and looking at meaning in life through interpreting meaningful coincidences. Or there are different ways that we can look at meaning in life where we might consider a larger kind of consciousness. And Viktor Frankl was also on about that, thinking that a lot of psychotherapy beforehand or treatment approaches were becoming too reductionistic. There's probably the influence of behaviorism, and he felt that in other ways that therapy wasn't as holistic as it could be. So when he talked about meaning and something larger beyond ourselves, serving something larger and faith, he was also raising notions of soul, which I think resonates with many people's interest in modern day psychotherapy, thinking there should be more soul in psychotherapy.
And we will get into these things a little bit more. Like today we'll obviously talk about who Frankl was and some of what his ideas were and even how relevant they are to many of the ideas that are popular today. But one of the things I find so interesting is, yeah, as you mentioned, I believe he was a Jewish man. And although he had this Jewish faith, he speaks about things in a language that I think everyone can understand. He really relates it to, I suppose, a modern lexicon in terms of the way that we speak about psychology and mental health and meaning in the world and all these sorts of things. Like, as someone who's not Jewish myself, there's no leaps that you really have to take, or there's nothing that you really need to, I suppose, learn a little bit more about in terms of the Jewish faith specifically. But although that was a great motivator for him, I think he was able to, for lack of a better term, bring people along for the ride in the way that he spoke about these things.
Yes, as you say, the way he wrote, it appealed so widely to so many people. It's, well, one of the most popular books for the general public as well, and something which goes into depth, but that is still accessible in the way you describe.
Well, let's get into a little bit of who Frankl was, because as we say, he's such a fascinating and inspiring character in so many ways. And we'll almost go through a little bit of a Wikipedia-style biography just to start off. We won't go too deep into his whole life story, but he's someone who, as you mentioned at the start, he went through the Great Depression, both world wars, Nazi occupation, and was in four different concentration camps where, as you said at the start, he lost his wife and his family. So someone who experienced just incredible hardship. But I suppose before that, he was a Jewish man who grew up in Vienna, and he always had an interest in psychology, and I believe meaning was something that he was really interested in from quite a young age. But as a teenager, he corresponded with Sigmund Freud after, I believe, writing to Freud and asking to publish one of his papers. And so he studied to become a physician, like a doctor, and after a little while he began to question Freud's approach to psychoanalysis and ended up studying under Alfred Adler, and I believe he published his second paper in Adler's journal, which was the Journal of Individual Psychology. So I suppose, do you want to give us a bit of a sense of who, obviously, maybe we know a little bit about Freud, but who were Freud and Adler in terms of their ideas?
Okay, so Freud thought that a key motivation for people was the pleasure principle. And in a way, that might seem to make sense. You know, do things that make you feel good, try and avoid things that cause you pain. Pleasure and pain, that would generally be a sensible kind of thing to focus on as a motivator, but maybe it's a bit simplistic because it's just looking at one individual and their response to a situation. So then Adler came along and he thought, no, we need to consider, when we look at motivation, people's relationship to other people. And Adler talked in terms of power. He thought the motivator, or if you like, the motivation, was how people interacted with each other in terms of power, or we could say influence in some ways. But Frankl thought that in the long run, those ideas were overly simplistic because people could be in the most dire of circumstances, like a concentration camp, and they're not likely to find much pleasure, yet there still could be something that motivates people to get up each day and go on and even have the will to live in some ways. And he thought that it's more than just people's relationship with others in terms of power. Because again, if you're in a concentration camp, you hardly have much power or influence really. So you can't really account for people's behaviour if they're managing with those circumstances and even getting up and going on with things each day, if you focus on pleasure and power. And he'd already thought about meaning beforehand, but his experience in a concentration camp led him to think even more that a primary motivator was not pleasure or power, but something broader again, which is meaning or purpose in life, having something to live for, having something meaningful to look toward, because he recognized that that helped many people keep going when they were in concentration camps, to the point that an observation he made, a famous observation, is he believed that those people who survived in concentration camps were more those who had some kind of sense of meaning or purpose. So he thought that that affected people's even survival, but also mental health or well-being in the long run, having this sense of meaning or purpose.
Well, we will get into a little bit of his experience in the concentration camps and his observations from them in a moment, but I suppose one of the things that I find so interesting is he seemed to have a bit of a sense of his ideas even long before he was in a concentration camp. Like, I believe it was 1926 when he started refining logotherapy, and so he'd had contact with Freud. He'd questioned Freud, I believe at the age of about 19 as well. He'd sort of started to question Freud's psychoanalysis. So you think, what a titanic intellect he must have had to, at that age, be able to perceive things to the degree of being able to question Freud. And then he found himself under Adler, and I believe he was actually expelled from Adler's circle of students for insisting that meaning was the central motivational force in human beings. So this was, I think, around 1925, early 1926. So it was clearly something that he had a real bee in his bonnet about, and well, it would have been, you know, horrendous circumstances to, I suppose, put some of these ideas to the test. But at the same time, I think certainly in a modern context anyway, like the concentration camps of World War II are almost seen as the archetypal environments of suffering.
Yes, and so before he went into the concentration camp, he'd been working with people who were suicidal and looking at therapy approaches that might help people who were suicidal. So he was already interested in what could motivate people to keep on going. But as you say, he'd already formulated a lot of these ideas to the point that when he was arrested in 1941, apparently he had a manuscript in his pocket. Now, of course, he lost that. He lost the whole book that he'd already basically written, this whole draft. And probably one of his motivators when he was in a concentration camp was ultimately to be able to get out those ideas out to the world. But in a very savage way, or the harshest of circumstances, he had this period of time where he had this extra life experience to, if you like, test out those ideas or reflect on those ideas when he couldn't have been tested any more than he was.
Well, absolutely. And we will get back to that little book. There is a little, I suppose, an anecdote that I wanted to bring up about that book, because it's just one of the most fascinating stories, I think. And so we will get back to that in just a moment. But I do want to mention that, so Frankl, I think in 1928 to 1930, when he was studying as a student, so he was learning to become a doctor, he organised youth counselling centres in Vienna in response to the high number of teen suicides that were occurring around end-of-year report cards. And so he took on this, it's such a valiant task in many ways, to look to curb the suicides of the youths of Vienna. And I believe after working for a couple of years on that program, by 1931, the year after he'd finished on that program, but there was no youth suicides in terms of students in Vienna. So Clearly, he made a profound contribution to, I suppose, even psychology in his local area, even long before he was able to make the contribution through logotherapy to the entire field of psychology.
Yes, and I wonder if there's a little echo to what we've talked about in previous weeks about the Greek philosophers, when we think about that, that there were more youth suicides around the end-of-year report cards. As you mentioned in a recent podcast, in a sense, be careful what you set your heart on. Now, there's a bit of a warning there. There's more suicides around report cards, achievement kind of thing. If people become overly focused on achievement, like how they do with exams and all the rest of it. Now, if your sense of what's meaningful comes back to something like, well, doing very well in these exams or something like that, there's something about that that can be a bit distorted or illusory. So again, sometimes we have to look at something deeper again or something more important again than what we might consider some form of popular success or what other people might pay attention to for a period of time. We can get hung up on things like that, on material things, on certain forms of success or perceived success or what other people think. And that certainly had come up in previous podcasts about the Greek philosophers. They were contemplating these things, and so Viktor Frankl, partly based on that kind of experience with youth, was developing further his ideas about what's a kind of deeper meaning in life, what are things that are more lasting or enduring to care about.
Well, I think there are so many links between Viktor Frankl's philosophy and the ancient Greek philosophers that we've been speaking about in recent weeks. Like, even to the degree to which he said, it is difficult to live a meaningful life without some understanding of the meaning of death and suffering. Like, I suppose, yeah, as we've spoken about the last couple of weeks, like the Epicureans, the Cynics, the Stoics, like, death and suffering and mortality, fatality, like these themes were certainly themes that they were very interested in. And I believe, well, as we get into it, there might have been a few other areas which people who have listened to the most recent podcast will recognise in terms of some of the philosophy. But I suppose just to get into maybe some of his experiences in the concentration camps, because I'm fascinated with, I suppose, what experiences Frankl went through to lead to his conclusions. Because in some ways, like, you almost just look at it at a surface level as someone who, you know, lives a relatively cushy life in 2024 now. You almost just wonder how it is that someone has been through such harrowing circumstances and is able to formulate such a positive philosophy at its most fundamental level in terms of, I suppose, staring all the negativity of life in the face and trying to come up with something that really is positive out of all that. And so I believe it was 1942, so just 9 months, sadly, after he was married, Frankl and his family were sent to a concentration camp, of which his father died of starvation and pneumonia at the concentration camp. And I believe he visited four different concentration camps throughout his time in the Second World War. And in 1944, Frankl and the surviving members of his family were transported to Auschwitz, where his mother and brother were murdered in the gas chambers. And his wife, Tilly, later died of typhus in Bergen-Belsen concentration camp. So it's my understanding that, well, I suppose seeing his wife was one of his motivating factors, was certainly where he derived a sense of meaning from. And it's so sad that he never did get to spend time with her after the war. But just to get even slightly ahead, and we'll just finish off the little Wikipedia biography, but following the war, he became the head of the neurology department at the General Polyclinic Vienna Hospital and established a private practice in his home. He worked with his patients until his retirement in 1970. But Dad, you mentioned that little book that I believe he had actually sewed into the lining of his coat when he was first taken to the first concentration camp, which I must admit, I'm not even going to try and butcher the pronunciation in terms of the German spelling. But of course, that jacket was taken off him when he arrived at that concentration camp. And as you say, it was a great motivating factor, I believe, for him to continue throughout the war and continue living so that he could republish his ideas or publish his ideas, having written the manuscript. But it took him 9 days after he was out, I believe it was 1946 at this stage, and he wrote this book, and he gave the book to his publisher, and I believe there was a chapter in there he included about being in the concentration camps and his experience of meeting all the prisoners and that sort of thing. And his publisher said, oh, look, really like this, but I think you should write a little bit more on your experience in the concentration camps. And that became Man's Search for Meaning. So 9 days it took him to rewrite this manuscript, and I believe as of today there's 16 million copies sold, and it was seen as one of the top 10 most influential books in America. And I believe, you know, just cheekily and quietly, there's a free version of it on the internet at PDF level. So imagine it's a lot more than 16 million people who have consumed Man's Search for Meaning and that manuscript that he wrote.
Yes, it's remarkable how that horrendous experience ended up becoming so much a focus of the book, and probably what helped it appeal to so many millions of people. Like, it sold millions of copies, apparently, and so many people related to it. And I wonder whether part of its appeal was because it illustrated something which I saw in a quote in an article that I noted at one stage, that even dark and joyless episodes of our lives can be times when we mature and find meaning. Well, what a way of highlighting a dark and joyless episode from which further meaning came than Viktor Frankl himself looking to survive and noting how other people around him were looking to survive in different ways and what helped them do that, and this notion of that sense of purpose helping people deal with the most dark times they ever faced.
Well, I think that's so true. And again, what an admirable response in terms of just a horrendous environment to ever have to find yourself in. And to not only face up to that, surrounded by people who I'm sure are just struggling basically to the depths of human emotion, but to really face that the way that he did. Like, I believe he said, if there is meaning in life at all, then there must be a meaning in suffering. Suffering is an ineradicable part of life, even as fate and death. Without suffering and death, human life cannot be complete. So, like, hey, it seems to me that that's quite a profound notion, and one that isn't, I suppose, intuitive in many ways. You know, particularly in the modern world, there's a real focus on positivity and the silver linings in life and this sort of thing. But I suppose to not have any sense of avoidance, really, while he was in the concentration camp, to not only face up to that, but to describe things in these terms, it seems that he really had a sense of, I suppose, suffering and death's role in life. And he was able to derive so much from that, that, as we'll mention a little bit more about in a moment, just had such a profound impact on the field of psychology going forward. But I also think maybe people's collective psyche a little bit too. Like, we look back at the concentration camps as one of just the worst times in human history in terms of how we treated each other to a degree. But I believe that Frankl has almost codified or structured things in a way where we all kind of benefit from what he thought.
Yes, and actually what you described there, his view, I've heard it described sometimes in modern terms as a tragic view of life, and a tragic view of life not being inconsistent with positive psychology. And I heard this expressed by a particular therapist, Robert Lay, who did a lot of work in terms of dealing with worry and things like that. Again, he highlighted it, a tragic view of life not inconsistent with positive psychology. Well, how's that? Well, as he described, well, when it starts off, I'm going to die, you're going to die, everyone we love and care about is going to die, that's tragic enough. And then there are bad things that happen, or traumatic things that happen, or terrible things that happen that can make life very difficult and extraordinarily challenging. And yet, there are things that make life worthwhile despite those facts, despite our mortality, despite the challenges that we might face, there are things that make life worthwhile. And so part of the question is, what kind of things make life worthwhile? And in looking at that kind of question, Viktor Frankl focused on meaning.
Well, in some ways, you know, I just really, you know, wonder how someone could come up with that conclusion and, I suppose, hold on to it through a concentration camp experience, because, gee, you wouldn't think there'd be much in there that would make life worthwhile, or you'd have this sense that life was worthwhile while you'd spent, you know, years in that environment, yet he did. And I'm interested to ask you about logotherapy and the influence that it's had on modern psychology, because I believe the Friedrich Nietzsche quote, which I love as a quote, in terms of whoever has a why can bear almost any how, I believe he took this as, in some ways, as an explanation for the way that some of his fellow prisoners were able to survive the experience in the concentration camp. And as you say, I believe those who he sensed had found a purpose to keep going and found meaning, even in those just disgraceful circumstances that were put in, they were the ones that had the best chance of survival. So I suppose how from that just dark, you know, at surface level, kind of purely negative experience, how was he able to extract some of these ideas from that experience?
Okay, well, in logotherapy, he described three different sources of meaning, three ways that people could find meaning, or three of the clearer ways that people could find meaning, which might even apply in a concentration camp or in our everyday lives in other ways. And so the first one he described was taking some kind of action through purposeful work or creativity. So doing something meaningful that draws on our abilities or attributes in some way. So I would think of that personal work idea as, again, something emphasized in positive psychology. If we use our top character strengths, engaged in activities that are of benefit to other people, that's meaningful. Using our top strengths for the benefit of other people is how Seligman defined a meaningful life. So the purposeful work or creativity. Then there's love. Loving others, caring about other people, that in itself being very meaningful. And as an example of that, I remember one time being at a spiritual community in northern Scotland called Findhorn. And there was a visiting speaker, and he was a yogi, I think, from India. And he's addressing this group that are looking at his spiritual wisdom. And he says, look, you're coming to me to get ideas on how you can develop this spiritual wisdom. He said, if you want to get in touch with spirituality, there's no better way than being a mother of 8 children. So in other words, he's sort of saying to people, look, you've all got the time here to come and see me. There's some people who are so engaged in doing loving things in their everyday life, in their connection with other people, that that's true spirituality in a certain kind of way. But you can also imagine, even in a concentration camp, that many people would have acted in ways of like supporting, care, doing kind things for their fellows, if you like, love for others. That's another source of meaning. And then a third one that he highlighted was finding courage in the face of adversity. And that's where people might, even more so than usual, when going through dark times, that's when that kind of meaning can come to the fore. So I've noticed that often when working with clients who've been through significant trauma in the past, there's something actually uplifting about seeing the way that people have recovered, maybe slowly, but over a period of time. They're dealing with maybe physical injuries, pain, as well as trauma. They might have lost loved ones in tragic circumstances. So when you work as a trauma therapist, you're basically seeing people who are showing courage, working through the therapy itself, trying to deal with the challenges that they've faced in the past, and often reaching a point where they've risen above that to the point where their ongoing life is worthwhile. They're finding meaning in life generally, and often with a refined sense of priorities. And I think that also came through in the way that Viktor Frankl spelled out and developed logotherapy. He would have had a highly refined sense of priorities after going through an experience like that. So each of these three things, when you think about it, it's looking at something beyond ourselves. As he said, these are kind of examples of self-transcendence, going beyond ourselves, beyond our ego, through purposeful work or creativity. So doing things for the benefit of others that might be like a legacy, leaving benefits for other people. Love, the caring and connection that we show to others, and finding courage in the face of adversity. These are three of the main ways of gaining a source of meaning.
Well, the thing that really stands out for me there is, like, if these things can, I suppose, show up, if they can be present in a Nazi death camp, like, again, to me, that's almost, you know, someone who grew up, say, in the 90s and the early 2000s, that period of history is seen as almost the biggest black mark in terms of maybe living memory or recent living memory in many ways. And the fact that, oh, I suppose, they were able to, well, yeah, still be present, people were able to still show those sources of meaning, like even purposeful action, love, finding courage in the face of adversity. Like the third one maybe seems a little bit obvious, but how indelible in terms of how hard is it to erase those elements from the human spirit? Like, this is a situation where people are basically tested, you know, more than certainly, you know, the vast majority of other people's existence in life. And the fact that, you know, he was still able to, I suppose, recognize these sources of meaning in that situation suggests that, well, hold on, I think these maybe elements of the human spirit really must be able to endure even, you know, ostensibly the worst set of circumstances that we can go through it as human beings.
Yes, and so important to have some sense of that when there are very dark experiences that no doubt will continue for all time. But currently we hear of what's happening in Ukraine, what's happening in Gaza at the moment. Like, there's some very dark times happening at this point. But also there's anxiety and concern about things like climate change. There are a whole lot of challenges and just different forms of existential anxiety that people might have in a more everyday way. We understand how many more people are concerned about cost of living and things like that, about housing. But it's the notion of stepping back and having a bigger picture appreciation of things. I think that's where also Viktor Frankl helped remind us that there's some bigger, deeper kind of issues to look at. There are things for us to feel grateful about, even if we don't have much, even if we don't have freedom, even if we barely have enough to eat to survive. There are circumstances where there are ways that, as he put it, we can still say yes to life.
Well, I think that's so true, and I believe he even went to go as far as to emphasise that the horrors of the Holocaust were an opportunity for him to discover ultimate meaning through faith in God. And so, obviously, he was a Jewish man and saw, obviously, suffering as a part of life. And he just had another little quote, which I feel draws these things together so well, where he said, "The meaning of life is to be discovered in the world rather than within a man and his own psyche, as though it were a closed system. It denotes the fact that a human being always points and is directed to something or someone other than oneself, be it a meaning to fulfill or another human being to encounter. The more one forgets himself by giving himself to a cause to serve or another person to love, the more human he is and the more he actualizes himself." So, like, he was someone who grew up, you know, experienced the Great Depression, experienced, well, certainly the First World War by this stage, and of course the Second World War. Like, the early to mid 20th century was not necessarily the most positive time. I think that's maybe understating the fact a little bit, but the fact that he still almost had this outward perspective that he coupled with more of an inward perspective as well, he really found that balance in terms of looking out at the world and deriving meaning from his set of circumstances, even though, you know, as you say, we've got some, you know, really horrible situations that we're exposed to in the moment, like Gaza and Ukraine and things like this. And he would have been the same, I think, in terms of he would have had a sense that, you know, it's not as if life is all, you know, unicorns and rainbows, but he was still able to look at things in a way and thought, hold on, actually, if I, you know, really lean into this and look at ways of how can I help other people and really wanting to get something out of life, I suppose, through giving himself and giving elements of himself, like, what a way to look at things. I suppose reminds me a little bit of that story that you mentioned a couple of weeks ago about a gentleman who was just really, really struggling and almost to the point of being suicidal. And someone said to him, look, you know, I'm not sure what more I can say other than go out and find someone less fortunate or less well off than you and go and help them. And I believe that gentleman really benefited from taking that approach to things. But that seems to be Frankl's kind of modus operandi in a way, like in a, I suppose, purely human way. it would have been fair enough for him to think, you know, woe is me, what a terrible situation that I'm in. You know, it's not fair to be in this situation. Yet he still had this perspective of almost looking out and thinking, well, you know, I've got to help other people. I've got to help the people around me. And even some of his observations that he made about his fellow prisoners, he still obviously had that real connection with, I suppose, the human aspect of mixing with people, even if it was in, a concentration camp.
Yes, so having that bigger picture, and when we think about it, applying it to everyday life, well, many of us are not going to be going through the rigors of being, I suppose, imprisoned or in a concentration camp or whatever. But also, we could be affected by our concerns about achievement or material things or dealing with comfort or discomfort. Well, the challenges that we faced with COVID and restrictions on our lifestyle in certain kind of ways, there are things that we can get more worked up about than we need to, about success versus failure, approval versus disapproval. If we think that someone's been unduly critical of us, or we think that people haven't reacted towards us the way that we might like them to, we can get hung up on little things. And so part of it's a reminder to, in a way, like, get over yourself, or the more minor things that we can get caught up in, look at the bigger kind of picture. As he emphasized, you don't go out looking to achieve, say, self-actualization like Maslow talked about, this feeling of fulfillment. Don't go about trying to achieve that as like a goal. Start off with that notion of self-transcendence. Do purposeful things. Be caring, loving towards other people. When you face challenges, look to find some of that courage or your own ways and purpose for moving forward in some way. To the extent to which we look for those things beyond ourselves, that can make a real difference. Now, that's extraordinarily difficult, for example, when people are depressed or people are going through a period of very heightened anxiety. We might find it very difficult to find that courage in ourselves at times like that. But any which way we look to get by, little bit by bit, it's that notion of looking to have a little bit of the extra focus on the outer and give ourselves credit for whatever effort we make in that kind of way. We don't have to be heroic in what we're doing, but it's kind of like where we turn our attention. But if we focus on a sense of being wounded, like not meeting our goals for success or not being in the material circumstances we'd wish to, we can make ourselves more miserable in different ways. I've seen a number of clients in the past have been very well off, but they've been miserable sometimes by focusing on their concerns about disapproval or failure or whatever. And you just see how much people have a lighter, freer approach to life as they reflect on those kind of things and maybe shift their priorities, sometimes after coming through a depression where they've learnt more about readjusting their priorities.
Well, it's so interesting because I think to a degree, like, absolutely, there's almost two ways that you can go with some things, and I think we'll find out a little bit more about that in terms of what Frankl had to say, because I know it was another big element of logotherapy. But I know from within my own experience, for example, I was having a period of depression, and coming through that, it gives you a greater understanding for every other time, you know, forevermore that you hear that someone is going through, even if it's not depression, that it might be another mental illness, and you think, oh, look, I may not have the lived experience with exactly what you're going through, but you almost have maybe a bit of a sense of empathy of or just the challenges that that person is facing at that time. And it seems that a lot of what Frankl was about was almost, even if it's a tiny little light bulb that, you know, very infrequently goes off in the back of your head in terms of, gee, there's other people who've been through this, and maybe I've, you know, have learned something out of my experience that I can talk to them about, or even sit with them and provide, you know, a listening ear and maybe a sense of understanding. And it seems that what Frankl was really trying to do was kind of leverage that almost little positive light bulb that goes off in the back of your head. And logotherapy was about obviously many things to do with meaning, but a big part of it in some ways seems to be this aspect of, well, how can I leverage almost these indelible aspects of human nature, which are a bit more positive in terms of, well, I do want to help people and provide love and do things which are going to be of greater benefit than to just myself.
Yes, and again, we can see some of the echoes of what the Greek philosophers were on about that we talked about in the last couple of podcast episodes. Ultimately, it's looking more deeply at what's most important in life. That's where they ended up. And just as an aside, it's interesting to consider that with logotherapy, one of the main techniques that they used was Socratic dialogue to help people find what was more meaningful. To be asking these deepening kind of questions or questions that would deepen our awareness of ourselves, gain greater understanding. So, yes, Frankl referred to Socratic dialogue, which we described in recent episodes as being a cornerstone of modern psychotherapy.
Well, it really seems that he certainly had a very great understanding of that period in Greek history. And that comes through with, I suppose, another one of his aspects of logotherapy, and that's the tragic triad. Do you want to just give us a sense of what is the tragic triad and maybe how does it relate to the light triad and the dark triad?
Okay, well, what Frankl meant by the tragic triad is the painful, challenging aspects of life like pain, emotional and physical, guilt, an emotion that people can feel, and death, that existential anxiety about the finality of death, and how people dealing with these challenges in life, pain, guilt, and death, can respond with either a dark triad or a light triad. Now, let's talk about the light triad. That's, say, responsibility. Say that notion of guilt, if we feel like we've done something wrong. One thing we can do is face up to that. Acknowledge, hey, look, I'm not perfect. I did something wrong. We might apologize or look to repent. But the idea is doing positive things, looking to improve the situation. Apologize, look to improve the situation. Basically, take responsibility. We're allowed to be imperfect. But if we go a different way, not the light triad of responsibility, but we look to avoid responsibility or play that down, or we won't accept that and accept any responsibility, then we might become narcissistic. So in other words, having slipped up in some way, we overcompensate for it. We make out, oh no, this has nothing to do with us. And then we react very negatively. If people saw us in any way as being responsible for a situation, we might just sort of reject that or see that as being just someone attacking us. So how do we deal with that sense of responsibility when we face difficult circumstances, including where we might have slipped up? Then the light triad, along with responsibility, is conscience. Using our conscience to look to do what is right. So not just going with the ego or not just doing what we feel like at the time, using our conscience to maybe rise above some kind of impulse or just trying to gratify ourselves in some way, think of what's the right thing to do. Whereas if we ignore that and we play that right down or don't act on conscience, that's where you get the psychopathy. A psychopath will just go for whatever suits them and not concerned with what's right or wrong. And then another one is in challenging circumstances, pain, guilt, or acknowledging death, faith. He talked about faith in some kind of ultimate meaning. In his case, that included a religious faith. But just say if someone doesn't have faith or they don't have a sense of ultimate meaning, then they're more likely to do whatever is expedient at the time to suit their interests. In other words, become Machiavellian. So Machiavellianism is just going for whatever you want at the time, just sort of being, you know, selfish, sneaky, using dirty tricks, whatever it takes to get what you want, serve your own interests, not care so much for other people. And so certainly Frankl highlighted a concern about leadership. He was concerned if leaders were not acting with responsibility, with conscience, with faith in some kind of ultimate meaning. And when you think about that, I think we see that being played out in a number of ways, like Putin and what's happened in Ukraine, and certainly Trump, when we look at his leadership, like taking responsibility, the notion of making excuses for himself all the time, certain patterns of narcissism, feeling attacked by other people, thinking that he had an election stolen from him, conscience, the notion of doing what's right, rather than seeming to act on principle or conscience, seeming quite psychopathic in my view, going for power at all costs, not considering so much consequences for other people, manipulating circumstances in different ways. So it's interesting that Viktor Frankl was highlighting concerns about how leaders were dealing with these challenges in everyday life, whether they were showing responsibility, conscience, faith. Well, I think it's such a pity that in 2024, when you'd hope that we can learn from this kind of wisdom, not just from the ancient Greeks, but also the kind of ongoing lessons about what's important, what influences people's well-being and communities' well-being. I think there are many examples where we're not seeing that played out on the international stage. And that was part of Frankl's message. Think about how these happen, be aware of that, and that's what also the Greek philosophers, including the Cynics, were on about. Meaning question organisations, how leaders go about things. Are they working on these fundamental principles that Frankl spelled out as responsibility, conscience and faith?
I think that's such an interesting way almost to operationalise these things. Like, obviously, Frankl, it's not as if he was someone who had this, you know, overly kind of optimistic view of life and expected necessarily people to act, say, with the light triad of responses. He clearly had some understanding about, well, actually, there really are two ways that you can go with some of these, you know, deep, dark facts of life. And he must have experienced a whole bunch of people who he recognised to maybe go down the dark path of things. And as you say, I believe some of his commentary on leadership certainly alluded to that. But I suppose it makes all the more reason to look into this stuff like at an individual level. Like, I know that Frankl maybe probably wouldn't have advocated for such an individual view of psychology and of looking at some of these things, but like, I must admit, look at that and go, well, in our political system today, like responsibility to repent, well, you'd lose your job in a lot of situations because we've got quite a black and white view of whether someone's done something wrong, they should just lose their job. Like, conscience to do what's right. Like, it seems to me that maybe things have devolved slightly more down party lines in recent years, and faith, not necessarily faith in terms of a religious faith. Like, I believe that was something maybe a little bit more prominent in American politics, maybe, say, maybe towards the end of the last century, it became slightly less emphasised, and now maybe even again, slightly less emphasis on the faith of our politicians. But to me, like that faith idea, like as I say, it doesn't necessarily have to be a religious thing. Like, to me, it can almost be a faith in that idea that a tragic view of life is not inconsistent with life being worthwhile, in terms of there's got to be a whole range of situations, you know, particularly as a leader and someone who's dealing with the issues of a community, where you're really going to be faced with some tragic views of life, or, you know, at the very least faced with the dark reality of some situations. And to then have faith and be able to think, no, there is a way that we can get through this that is, you know, a net benefit to my community. Well, that's such an important part of being a leader, and I wonder to what degree that's maybe been internalised by some of our current leaders, and, you know, not to name specifics in that sense, but I believe that would be an important part of leadership. But, Dad, let's have a little bit of a chat about how this relates to a modern context, because Frankl is someone who does come up, you know, quite regularly. I just had a little cursory look at, you know, Twitter, for example, is something that I get a lot of news from. And quite often you get just a bit of a finger on the pulse view of things where, you know, you type something into Twitter, like, say, Viktor Frankl in this sense, and you can see, well, even today, there's been a whole bunch of people who are quoting his name and putting up some quotes that he said in a whole range of languages too. So he's clearly someone who's got still quite a prominent influence on the world. But I suppose to your mind, what is Frankl's lasting impact from logotherapy and even beyond in terms of his ideas in a wider community context?
Well, certainly I think that one of the main developments in psychotherapy in recent times is more of an emphasis on a spiritual dimension in life, which doesn't have to be religious, but also finding meaning in different ways. And this is most obviously potentially in the field of positive psychology, where there's a lot of current research and recent research on meaning and the physical and mental well-being benefits of people experiencing a greater sense of meaning and purpose in life. And we'll talk about that in an upcoming podcast, maybe a couple of podcasts from now, looking at meaning, purpose in life, and the particular benefits of that that show up in research. And again, that draws strongly on Michael Steger's work that I've described beforehand, but many other researchers as well. But I think also the research on spirituality, which is being acknowledged more, it's been known for decades that when people have certain spiritual beliefs, that that can have physical and mental health benefits. But I think a lot of that was de-emphasized, even in the positive psychology field, because of concern that something that related to spirituality or religious beliefs, but certainly spirituality, maybe didn't seem so scientific. But the science shows that having certain spiritual beliefs can be helpful, which is partly my perspective, where if people, say, experience synchronicity or meaningful coincidences or any other ways that they find meaning from their experience, that can be beneficial to mental health. And other people might think, oh, that's just being superstitious, either through religious beliefs or thinking that coincidences are ever anything more than just a coincidence. But to me, there's a lot of evidence that shows that if people find meaning from those experiences and they relate that to their life and their life direction in some ways, well, that can be helpful and make a difference. And we'll talk about some of that research in an upcoming episode.
And the thing that I find so interesting with some of this sort of stuff is, I suppose, how explicitly, really, people do talk about things like meaning and purpose these days. Like, you know, I wasn't necessarily around sort of mid to late last century, but certainly in my time, maybe as a young adult, and, you know, I suppose I've kind of been tapped into this in terms of this is something that I'm very interested in. But I feel like a lot of young people today have a real sense of, well, the aspect in life which meaning and purpose really contribute to. Like, I think, for example, there's, well, maybe a lot more people now who wouldn't work for an organisation who disagreed with their values. Or we see it with sponsorships in sport, for example, and athletes coming out and, you know, saying that they don't agree with, say, the way that some of their sponsors make money, for example. It's almost like people have more of a sense of, well, how important meaning and purpose is, and wanting to contribute to something positive and having their own maybe set of values that they see as meaningful. And so I think it is something that maybe is a little bit more prominent in terms of the way that we explicitly speak about these things.
Yes, I think one of the ways that comes up too is if we look at, say, career directions. If you go back a couple of generations, it's almost as though there were more rigid guidelines, if you like, informal guidelines even, for what people might do. So for males, it would be seen as almost like a pinnacle of achievement to be studying, for example, medicine and law. For women, it was thought, no, the main roles for women would be nursing and teaching and, well, maybe mothering ahead of all of that. So kind of prescriptive and rigid. Now, I think it's far more differentiated, the notion of what people might do or what might suit them or what their unique skills or attributes or interests might be. So I think that's one thing which has improved greatly over the last couple of generations, that notion of people having more freedom to be themselves, which is partly the notion that Jung would have talked about as individuation. But part of that becoming more fully ourselves in a satisfying way, Viktor Frankl was reminding people, also that notion of self-transcendence. We can pursue things that we're interested in. We can follow our own path, but it'll make a real difference if in doing so we have a sense of meaning, partly also from serving other people or something larger than ourselves.
Well, I think that's so true. And the other thing that I find really interesting about this is, you know, looking at some of this sort of stuff, and I know he's a bit of a character who's on the nose these days. He's maybe got lost in the weeds of some of the political aspects of his message. But I think a lot of this kind of stuff is what, for example, Jordan Peterson was on about a few years ago, and some of the reason why he rose to such prominence. And I can think of some other prominent people who I've followed, say, in the last, you know, even 10 years or so, like John Vivacki, for example, who we spoke about in the last couple of podcasts. His Awakening from the Meaning Crisis lecture series provided a lot of the information for those couple of episodes, and even, you know, awakening from the meaning crisis. Like we have a sense that people are really yearning for, I guess, a little bit more structure around meaning, or they're yearning for maybe some more understanding of Viktor Frankl's point of view and his perspective on life and some of the things that he was able to apply in what was, you know, such an adverse situation as being in a concentration camp. Like, they're just, you know, two examples off the top of my head, but it just really strikes me that this stuff, although, I think it has become a little bit more prominent in terms of people have a bit more of a sense of meaning and purpose, it's not as if maybe people have internalized maybe the whole aspect of what Frankl was saying. Like, I even look at, say, the three sources of meaning, like purposeful work or creativity, love, and finding courage in the face of adversity. I think there's maybe some situations in modern life where people have experienced adversity, and maybe their reaction is not to, I suppose, lean into that and find a way through that that's going to, you know, provide positivity in the long run. They might just think, oh, you know, this isn't fair that I've been put in this situation, or maybe someone owes me something that's, you know, not going to see me in this unfair situation. I think maybe if we go back to some of this sort of stuff and recognize that, well, a big part of what Frankl was saying was taking personal responsibility for things. And that was obviously something that Jordan Peterson was really on about, and others as well. And so I think there is an appetite for, well, this information and Frankl's experiences and learning a little bit more about, we'll say, logotherapy and how that can relate to psychology. We've even, say, spoken in the past about, say, the medical model in psychology and in medicine, and it seems that Frankl wouldn't necessarily have agreed with the medical model in terms of maybe it's sucking some of the soul and the spirituality out of things. I think he really had a sense of these things being very important.
Yes, he certainly had a holistic view of things. And look, a couple of things I'd like to mention there. One is in terms of dealing with challenges in life. Well, all of us, wherever we live on Earth, basically, will have faced challenges with a pandemic. And I think that's a personal litmus test. We can look back at how do we deal with particular challenges from the pandemic. And there are probably some things that we managed with in a constructive way. There might have been some ways we made adaptations, or there might be some ways that we recognised what was more important to us in our everyday lives or work, or when we were restricted from doing certain things, we might reflect back on some of the things that could relate to, say, personal work or creativity that maybe it was more difficult to engage in, and so how we appreciate being able to do them now, or say love, if we didn't have the same physical connection or contact with loved ones, family, friends, appreciating the opportunity now further that way, but also recognizing any ways that we did show some kind of courage in the face of adversity. When it boils down to it, I think that was a test that all of us went through, where there could be a degree of pain, that there could be also facing that prospect of illness or disruption that way. For elderly people or vulnerable people, there was also an increased threat of death. But I suppose that's one way we can reflect on how have we personally dealt with adversity, how we dealt with the pandemic.
Well, I think there's really something in that in terms of the pandemic, and absolutely what an experience we all would have had to face varying degrees of adversity. But I suppose just to finish off with me, Dad, and I know there's a couple more things that I'll ask you about in just a moment. But so I believe Frankl, basically in his later life, it was long after the war, one of his students was asked to basically sum up Frankl's purpose himself and his sense of meaning. And he, I believe, said that she kind of nailed it when she said, "His entire purpose has been that any of us can say yes to life in spite of everything." And I think that's such a good point. And I suppose just to quickly finish off from me, like, I had an experience, say, earlier in my life where I lost a friend, and lost a friend to suicide, and basically made the decision, you know, at that point, you know, having experienced that, I can never do something like that. And, you know, not to cast aspersions on anyone, it was just me from my position being close to that situation, thought, you know, I just can't know that and put people through it. But I suppose, yeah, in some ways that was something that I've almost kind of, you know, dealt with, or I suppose for a little while struggled with in some ways. And to me it's so uplifting to, I suppose, see Frankel, who's really gone through, you know, just the worst of the worst in terms of, you know, being treated, you know, horribly as a human. And he's able to, I suppose, come to that conclusion and build an entire kind of field of therapy around it. And, you know, we're seeing, you know, the numbers of suicides at really alarming rates. Like, to be honest, one's an alarming rate. But the fact that there are so many suicides in our culture, that idea of almost going, well, you know, we're not going to give ourselves, you know, any other option other than saying, you know, yes, and trying to get as much out of life. It just seems to me that Frankel is someone who, well, we can almost build upon as a bit of a foundation and obviously draw from a whole range of other areas. But as someone who really did face, you know, some of the, you know, the darker side of humanity, the fact that he was able to come to that conclusion and, I suppose, provide a bit of a structure and provide some operational aspects to it as well in terms of, say, like the three sources of meaning and the dark triad versus the light triad, and almost giving you these ways of thinking about things which are going to help with that idea of, you know, I'm just going to say yes in every situation. Like, to me, that is quite uplifting, that there is almost a philosophy out there that allows us to go, you know what, no matter what situation I'm in, I'm just going to find a way through it and then try and, you know, get something out of it. And look, there's plenty of uplifting examples out there of people who've really taken that on board. But I think in terms of maybe the rationality side of things, Frankel is someone who can really lead us in a good direction.
Yes, that saying yes to life, such a fundamental thing. And that's one thing that I find uplifting with seeing clients come through depression and then find ways that life is worth living, getting back to their purposeful work, loving others, and having shown courage of getting through that. And look, I'll mention too, I relate to that through personal experiences I've talked about before on this podcast, having gone through a couple of periods of severe depression, including my early 30s, being hospitalized twice, even though I'd been a senior psychologist for 5 years, worked as a psychologist for 10. At a certain point, I couldn't see any particular future. But like they say, that when you go through periods of even the most dark and joyless episodes, that was the most dark and joyless episode for me, naturally, being hospitalized with depression. But when they say at times it can lead to finding meaning, well, that certainly had, in the long run, profound benefits to me of looking back and realizing how I had to tackle the perfectionism, which was really getting so much in my way. And the earlier time when I was around about, say, 20 and severely depressed, not hospitalized then, but severely depressed, that's actually where I found a lot of my life direction or meaning of working as a therapist. So when I started working as a psychologist in a psychiatric hospital, it was actually something so satisfying after having gone through a period of suicidal depression myself, and with the help of a therapist getting through that gradually over something like a 6-month period, and then later on another period of getting through that, some of the best things that have happened in my life have come from a more refined understanding of what's important and what's not, coming through times like that. And I might mention that I talked about that experience, well, I suppose I wrote about it in a chapter for the book Second Chances, compiled by Ken Harris. Ken Harris, who we're going to interview on probably our next podcast. And so Ken Harris got a number of people together who'd gone through very painful, life-threatening, challenging situations. People had severe physical injuries, life-threatening illnesses, in my case, depression. Other people had difficulties with drug addiction, but found a way through it eventually in a way that good things came from it. So hopefully it's uplifting stories in that book, Second Chances. And I mentioned I also did a podcast interview with Ken Harris, where he interviewed me about my recovery from depression. And we'll put a link on this podcast when that's available. But also we'll be interviewing Ken for our Psych Spills podcast, because it has that theme in it. What can look like the worst thing that can possibly happen, how good things can come out of that. And that's what's, I suppose, pointed to in the title, Second Chances.
Well, yeah, I'm very much looking forward to chatting to Ken about that and hearing a little bit more about that book, Second Chances, because it feels like it's going to draw together some of what we've spoken about in the last few weeks in terms of we've got the philosophical side of things. You know, we've done a little bit of that sort of stuff now, and it'll be good to hear maybe a few more examples as well of people who've really put these ideas, not just to the test, but really adopted these philosophies in the face of trying circumstances. But well, thanks for chatting with me about all this today, Dad. It's been a good podcast to look into Viktor Frankl's stuff. And he is someone, not like Marcus Aurelius that we spoke about last week, where you can't necessarily read his quotes as kind of quotes to change your beliefs. Well, Viktor Frankl, you can just read his quotes for days. And so many of them are just absolutely profound, and I've learned a lot from even just reading his quotes. So, thanks for chatting with me about all this today. I look forward to the next one.
Look forward to it, Rowan.